Hey, everybody. Welcome back. We're here for our conversation. I'm calling it a conversation, not a podcast, because this is sort of our normal business. We just talk and people are seeing our, you know, how we think about things.
It's just the regular day here at the FDA.
Regular day.
Today's been a really big day, though. The two of you have actually published a new vaccine framework, COVID-19 framework, in the New England Journal of Medicine. I was actually just reading it today.
Thanks.
Congratulations, you two.
A lot going on today.
Yeah.
Big day.
Let me hang on to that. My mom's going to put on the refrigerator when I get home.
Yeah. You have to frame it for her and send it over. I mean, I got a haircut. I mean,
well,
there's a
my
lot.
Boss did
oh
tell
my
me
gosh,
in no uncertain terms.
Where's Albert Einstein? I don't see him anymore.
It's a little peer pressure, but when your boss is talking about your haircut.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's been a big day, and you just finished kind of a big live stream explaining the framework. So I thought we could really go dig into breaking it down and answering some questions that I've been thinking about, and I'm sure others have been thinking about, if that's
great.
Okay.
So we're talking COVID vaccine boosters.
Yes.
And the framework for regulation for future approvals.
Yeah. So let's start with basics. Where I'm thinking about my grandma at home who doesn't really understand this, right? But she knows what about COVID-19 boosters. What is the difference between a vaccine and a drug? I think it's important just level set on kind of definitions. You mentioned this earlier in your talk, right? A vaccine is different from a drug.
Well, I always say that vaccines and drugs should be treated similarly in the sense that when given to the right person at the right time, they both can have benefit. But you know, not every drug is perfect and not every vaccine is perfect. But a vaccine basically is something that creates an immunologic response in the person, so you can either fight off a virus, not acquire a virus, do better if you were to get the virus, and there's even a category of vaccines called cancer therapeutic vaccines where you fight off the cancer you've got if you have a cancer and get one of those vaccines. So, you know, sort of a broad category, but basically means the immune system is doing some work in the body and we are training the immune system based on a product we're administering, typically an injection.
Are you hopeful about cancer vaccines in general? Are you hoping something good comes out in that space?
Every oncologist, you know, our first mantra is hopeful. I mean, we're always hopeful. And in the last, you know, 15 years I've been an oncologist, there have been so many revolutions in cancer medicine.
Yeah.
So I continue to be excited. I can't discuss specific products, but actually one came to mind. There are a number
good
of products.
Good line, by the way.
I can't discuss specific products. Yeah. But there are a number of cancer therapeutic vaccines in the pipeline that have preliminary data that's promising. And more broadly, immunotherapy has been sort of a major boon in the cancer space.
You know, I think one of the coolest things about this type of work is the pipeline. What you see that is potential, that is, looks promising, that might provide hope. I mean, I think there are a number of conditions we as doctors treat where we just assume these are incurable, they're terminal, there's just nothing we can do. And you really get excited about coming to work here and learning about what's in the pipeline. But anyway, cancer vaccine, so that's interesting to get your perspective. We've come a long way from the first vaccine, that is the cowpox virus, right, that gave cross immunity protection
to smallpox
in the late 1700s. Dr. Jenner brought it to the U.S. A Harvard physician proposed this to President John Adams at the time.
Wow.
Nothing came out of it. I don't know what happened. Maybe he didn't get the communication. Maybe he received it and rejected it. I don't want to slander him. I'm sure he was a nice guy.
Yeah.
But Thomas Jefferson ended up implementing the National Vaccination Program. And so vaccines have done a lot of amazing things in the United States. The anthrax vaccine, that was a total disaster. Not the swine flu vaccine, that was a disaster. Not the rotavirus, early first version of that, that was pulled from the market.
For intussusception. Yeah.
Intussusception, that's right,
there have been some HIV vaccines that have actually increased the transmission of HIV, not decreased it. And malaria vaccine has been the holy grail, you know, a malaria vaccine. A number of people have been working in that space for 20, 30 years, and that's been a fraught space. But your point's well taken. Vaccines can be miraculous when done well. And also, there have been missteps in the history of medicine.
Do vaccines prevent illness?
Yeah, so I would say that many of the vaccines the public thinks about are vaccines that, when given to people, they don't acquire the illness, or when given to enough people, they don't acquire the illness. For instance, if you get a Hep B vaccine, you're not going to get Hep B. If enough people in a population get the measles vaccine, you're not going to see spread of measles. The COVID-19 vaccine was always hoped for, you know, that it would stop the spread of COVID-19. But unfortunately, it didn't. You know, everyone who's received a COVID-19 vaccine and everyone who didn't has eventually been exposed to SARS-CoV-2, the virus, and gotten COVID. So COVID-19 vaccines don't prevent you from getting the virus, but what they did do very clearly in the first quarter of 2021 and in the trials in 2020 was that if you were to get it, you're much less likely to get severe disease, hospitalization, and those endpoints were, you know, more important. But there's a broader question, which is you get a huge benefit from the first dose, and you may get some additional benefit from the second dose, but how many doses do you need before you sort of hit the plateau of the benefit you're going to get?
Your B and T cells being sort of optimized to prevent severe illness, because that's really what everyone's concerned about, right? Severe illness. So with the HPV vaccine, it's recommended to get two before age 15 and three after age 15, and it's interesting because the number of doses thought to be required to get that sort of optimized B and T cell protection against severe illness or against severe infection changes with age, which kind of is in line with the new vaccine framework for the COVID-19 boosters that you've laid out.
So that's a really good segue to the COVID-19 booster framework. But before we get into that, did I say that wrong?
Yeah. No, it's right. This is the big moment we've been waiting for.
Yeah. So
drum roll.
Before we get into what you're proposing with the framework, I think it's important to understand, like, what is the current state when it comes to the booster?
The COVID-19 vaccine boosters. I think the current state is that we have entered, you know, almost unwittingly, a paradigm where every individual above 6 months and older is recommended every year to get an annual COVID-19 shot.
For life. So if they live to age 80, that's 80 shots.
Maybe 84 shots because the first few, it's like 83 shots. Yeah, I mean, it seems to many people a big open question, you know, should a seven-year-old get seven shots, an eight-year-old get eight shots? You know, what is the right number of shots to get the maximum benefit for severe disease, but also not to overdo something. And so our regulatory framework that we have outlined in the New England Journal paper really strikes a balance. You know, for folks who are at high risk of severe outcomes, those over the age of 65, and those with at least one risk factor for severe disease, we are going to expedite the approval of products based on immunogenicity, which basically means prove to me that you get antibodies against the virus, and we're going to make those products available to those high-risk groups. But for people at low risk, healthy people, we're going to ask the companies to do what we often ask, which is generate evidence in a clinical trial that these additional doses have a benefit for people. And the specific age group we've suggested and agreed upon with some of these companies is 50 to 64, a place where if you look across the globe, there's a lot of differences of opinion. Some countries go down to 45 and some go to 65. 65 and up there tends to be consensus, but 50 to 64, you know, there's differences of opinion. So we're gonna go into that difference of opinion space, a kind of place we call equipoise, where we genuinely are uncertain, and generate some relevant data for the American people. And the doctors, who quite frankly, don't know what to do.
They're hungry for data.
Hungry
if somebody comes to you 52 years old and perfectly healthy, and they're asking you, should I get my fifth or sixth COVID booster? I mean, I don't have any evidence to inform an educated, strong recommendation.
It's been a guessing game.
It's been a guessing game.
And to clarify to what you said earlier, right, that fifth or sixth, seventh, eighth, you know, 80 shots, that is different than what we have for other vaccines like HPV, where it's two or three, right?
Where we kind of believe we've optimized the
right
B and T cell cellular.
So we're an outlier in how we're currently doing this.
We're an international outlier. Now, I'm sure based on your announcement today and the lecture that you gave and live streamed, the media is going to call you a contrarian. I'm going to predict it.
Yeah, contrarian, their favorite word.
Yeah.
But as you point out, the United States is the contrarian.
Yes.
I mean, Norway and Sweden and United Kingdom and Austria and Germany, they don't have this one-size-fits-all policy. They don't go after young people, healthy young people, year after year, extol them to get a shot without evidence that that shot has benefit. They target elderly high risk, and now we're falling in line.
And not just recommended, I mean, mandates and colleges, I mean, so that's one piece that you pulled for this New England Journal paper out today that I just love, the vaccine recommendation for the COVID booster.
By country.
In other countries, by country. In Australia, you have to be over 65 and high risk.
And can we clarify how we're defining high risk?
Well, we're going to go by a fairly well accepted standard, which is the Centers for Disease Control have a list of high-risk conditions. It's detailed in our article. It is a living document. They do update that list. It's a broad document. I mean, it's a broad set of conditions, including obesity, physical inactivity, depression, and pretty much any condition that makes someone immunocompromised is included in that list.
How about Albert Einstein hair? Is that a risk factor?
That risk factor has been mitigated.
Okay, United Kingdom, you have to be 75 years of age and high risk to have a COVID booster recommended to you. France, 80 years old and high risk. I mean, the United States is the country and we are the international outliers.
Yeah.
And that's a really good point.
And I think when, you know, those of us who have, I ran a laboratory, we had an international group of people. I've got people from Switzerland, from France, and from the UK in my lab working with me. They look at our COVID policy and they think, boy, what's wrong with the Americans? Why are you so far outside the accepted mainstream consensus? Medical dogma.
Well, we have to back up. I don't understand. So this agency, reviewed evidence to put out this recommendation and approve things in the past. How did they get it wrong? If every other country is following one set of evidence, what were we looking at?
I guess I'd say one thing is, the circumstances have changed over time. I mean, I don't want to play Monday morning quarterback and say who got things right or wrong, but the circumstances have substantively changed. Most Americans have had COVID, not just once or twice, but perhaps many times. Sometimes they may not even know how many they've had it. Our hospitals are no longer overflowing with patients with severe disease. The rates of severe disease are down. And just as the population severity of the virus has changed, so too should our regulatory framework change to accommodate that. Now, of course, there have always been philosophical differences between Americans and Europeans, and those will continue, and there's small differences around the edges. But broadly, we're basically bringing our policy up to speed with what we're dealing with right now.
So in that group, the high-risk group, where you're saying that you're envisioning a framework for approval without a pre-existing randomized controlled trial on that particular new vaccine, you are suggesting that you still want to see data, but it can be done in the post-marketing commitment.
Absolutely. And that's a kind of flexibility we often have at the FDA. We make things available early, particularly for life-threatening conditions, but we also fact check on the back end, make sure we're getting what we thought. And so our framework is both. You're over 65 high risk, you're going to get early access through immunologic endpoints, and then hopefully the companies complete the agreed upon, and I fully expect that they will complete the agreed upon post-marketing commitments, and they generate that randomized evidence, and that evidence will be informative into the future. The other thing people may ask is, they say, well, by the time you get the evidence, it'll already be out of date because the virus keeps changing. But the simple fact is the virus is not changing like influenza changes. It's changing, some of our data suggests, 24-fold slower than influenza. And the WHO is still endorsing in this season JN1, or vaccines that target JN1, which they also endorsed a year ago. So this is not influenza. This is a vaccine. This is a virus that spreads in the summertime in air-conditioned environments. This is a virus where you can generate data. And we have an obligation at FDA to only approve products where we believe with confidence that the benefits outweigh the harms. And I think we can say that for high-risk people, for older people, but for low-risk people, we need additional evidence to be able to say that with confidence.
Because it's been 4 or 5 years since we've had a randomized trial. There's much more population immunity now.
Much more.
And so it sounds like you don't envision needs for a randomized controlled trial each year, but is my understanding correctly?
I think, this may not even be a shot that's a yearly shot. Maybe it should be a shot offered when the virus changes, when the antigen of the virus substantively changes.
A shift.
And that's different from the flu vaccine.
The flu, flu is a virus with lots of reassortment. It's a shifty virus.
It's very shifty.
It's shifting all the time. And in fact, in some ways so quickly that sometimes our flu vaccines don't exactly match the strains that end up circulating. It's always a bit of a guessing game. But COVID-19, we'll let the virus tell us how often we need to reassess our strategy, see its mutation rate, see where we are in 18 months. And maybe this isn't a every 12-month shot, but maybe in every 18 month or every 3 years or every, I don't know the answer. I'll let biology dictate that, not my opinion.
Bigfoot has seen very leaky polymerases in the influenza. Bigfoot here?
Oh, there he is.
There he is. People were asking me if he's a real guy. Look at this guy, man. Awesome. Good to see you, Bigfoot. And Vinay and Sanjula here have been excited to see you. So, thanks for popping in.
He's a Cambridge AV tech.
Yeah. So I know we don't have too much time left, but...
Well, that's because the boss wants me to go do some things.
No,
the boss told me he gave me a big to-do list today, and so I gotta do these things. First thing on the to-do list is get a haircut, check. Develop a new vaccine framework, check. And now I gotta pick up his dry cleaning, so I gotta get out of here.
But I think, you know, one thing when we talk about vaccines, you know, there's this kind of question about what does the FDA do versus what does CDC do? And I think it's important just to kind of clarify what our role in this is.
Yeah, so we look at the evidence and issue licenses, or what's generally known as an approval, based on claims that match existing evidence. And so that's generally the role of the FDA as a regulator, and then the CDC has a recommendation schedule that's independent of the FDA. So that's a little bit how, you know, we're different from the CDC in the sense that we're not recommending or not recommending. We're looking at evidence and applications. And so I think, you know, this is a bit of a turning point in the sense that we are not going to be rubber stamping every single vaccine booster that comes here to the FDA without a clinical trial or clinical evidence or citing evidence from 4 or 5 years ago. And so I think people want to know what the data shows. Yeah. 85% of healthcare workers said no to the last COVID booster. That says something.
That says
either they're hungry for some updated evidence, it's been too long, or they have concerns.
Yeah, and I think that most doctors I know will be responsive to the evidence. If it shows overwhelming benefit of these products in 50 to 64, they're gonna go out there and endorse it with passion because they'll have evidence to guide those conversations. If those studies are in fact null or negative and it doesn't have much benefit, then I think it'll make us rethink what we're doing here. And we'll have to perhaps think about other ways to generate evidence. So
just to make sure I'm tracking that. So to date, there really has not been strong evidence of studies conducted on those healthy populations to show if there is a benefit.
Besides the initial studies. I mean, I don't want to take away from the initial studies in my mind were well done studies, randomized controlled trials launched in 2020 that showed reduction in symptomatic SARS-CoV-2. As well as trends toward improved severe disease for both Pfizer and Moderna, and those were and Johnson & Johnson at the time, and we had evidence early on that was robust. But then we slipped into this paradigm where booster after booster, dose 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, and the evidence for these subsequent doses was always more and more ambiguous and uncertain. Some people point to what they call observational studies, where they say, well, let's go look in the population, look at people who got 6 versus 5 doses, see who did better. But we all know the people who choose to get 6 and the people who don't, they're different groups of people. And so we have this bias there, which is the type of person who seeks that extra dose. And only the studies that we propose get around that bias.
Well, Vinay, thank you for bringing us closer to the international community on how they approach vaccines. So that's great. Sanjula, any other?
No, I mean, I think this is a great step in the merging common sense and gold standard science together. So I'm really excited to see where this goes.
We would talk for another hour.
I know.
Except
you've got to
give a lecture right now.
I do.
I do. But the
yeah.
public should certainly check out this paper because I think it's really helpful in understanding the framework.
Yeah. And thanks for the opportunity, Commissioner, and thank you for putting this conversation together.
Great hair. Great to see you. Great job. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.